come on a journey with a cinephile.
Wake up, sucker. We're thieves and we're bad guys. That's exactly what we are.
We was getting too big for our bitches.
Excellent day for an exorcism.
What have you done to its eyes?
I said, I'm not gonna hurt you. I'm just gonna bash your brains in.
What's your favorite scary movie?
Biddy well, little brother. Biddy well.
Hello and welcome, listeners, to Journey with a Cinephile, a horror movie podcast. As always, I'm your tour guide here of David Garrett Jr., recording out of Columbus, Ohio. And on this episode here for you is going to be my Women Appreciation number 7. As not the greatest double feature, as I was kind of already saying on the last outro, but the first movie I have is Infinity Pool. I checked this one out because it featured Mia Goth, and I kind of wanted to represent her on this one, and it was a new horror movie in the theater. And then I paired this up with Kathy's Curse, which is kind of an interesting movie here where, I mean, we have a little girl as the main, but there's also some interesting commentary with the mother in that movie, but I'll get into that during my review over there. And then for the mini reviews here, I have for you a very brief kind of talk about Moon Knight. Not a horror show, but there are some adjacent parts in it. Then I also got to watch The Beyond. My traverse through the threes is going to be Mystery of the Wax Museum. Then I also got to watch Fear, Victor Crowley, and New Terminal Hotel. That Fear movie was another one in the theater. That's a 2023 release. But before I kind of get over to those mini reviews, I did want to do my
monthly review.
So this is for, of course, January of 2023, you know, kicking off this new year here. And for this, I watched 48 total movies. 28 of them were horror movies. 7 of them are 2023 releases. My percentage of horror is 58.33%. Now, the horror movies that I watched during the month are The Hunchback of Notre Dame. This is the one from 1923. Mark of the Devil, Knife of Ice, Megan, Haosu, King Kong, The Untold Story, Bermuda Island, Friday the 13th, the original one, The Offering, Rituals, Skinamarink, Son of Kong, Pumpkinhead, Friday the 13th Part 2, Quaiden, Sorority House Massacre, The Invisible Man, this is the one from 33, Sorry About the Demon, Darkman, Infinity Pool, Chrome Skull, Laid to Rest 2, Kathy's Curse, The Beyond, Mystery of the Wax Museum, Fear, this is from here in 2023, Victor Crowley, and New Terminal Hotel. Now, 12 countries were represented, and they are the United States, West Germany / Germany, Italy, Spain, New Zealand, Japan, Hong Kong, United Kingdom, Bulgaria, Canada, Hungary, and France. Now, my 2023 watches are Megan, Bermuda Island, The Offering, Skinamarink, Sorry About the Demon, Infinity Pool, and Fear. Now, my oldest watch was The Hunchback of Notre Dame from 1923. Average year was 1994. The highest rated was Friday the 13th at a 9. And there's something on this episode as well that ties there. Lowest rated was, both of them are on this episode here, and they both are 4s. My average rating was a 7.3. Now, the only thing not appearing on the main podcast feed, well, it's all on the main podcast feed, but not actually on this podcast, is Friday the 13th and Part 2. They were both done with my wife over as a bonus episode here on this show. So how does this January stack up with other Januaries? Now, this is the most new films I've ever watched at 7, as previously it was 3 years tied at 5 with 2018, 2020, and 2022. And then it looked like 2021 was 4, and then 2019 was 3. Now, I've watched 29 total horror movies that were released in that year. And then horror films, this is kind of in the middle here. The highest was last year at 35. 2021, I had 30. This year, I had 28. And then 2018 and 2019, I had tied at 25. Lowest was 2020 at 23 movies. I've watched 166 horror movies in the month of January. So then for total films, this is my highest I've ever had at 48. Last year, I had 46. Year before that, 41. Then the year before that, 36. 2018, I had 35. And the lowest was 2019 at 30. I watched 236 movies in the month of January since I've been keeping track. Now, for the average year, this is actually the lowest, and it's 1994. 2021 was 96. 2018 was 99. 2019 was 2000. And then last year was 2001. The average year of all of these is 2001. And then average rating here, this is going to be kind of on the lower end, as at a 7.3. The lowest was actually 2018 and 2019 at a 6.9 for the average. Nice. And then I also had 2020 was 7.4, 2022 7.6, 2021 7.7. Average rating, though, of everything is a 7.3. And then percentage of horror, this is my lowest, actually, at a 58.33%. And then I had in 2018, 71.43, 2019, 88.33, 2020, 63.89, 2021, 73.17, last year, 76.09. And the average percentage of horror is a 71.04% of everything that I have been watching. So then, just to kind of see how this is going to be stacking up right now, I did some math on some of the things, and it looks like for new horror movies, I should be at 8.3 new released horror movies. So I'm a little bit below that by a movie and some change. And then for horror movies, I really need to be doing 30.4 over every month, a little bit under that at 28. And then total movies, 41.7. I'm actually above that right now. So I'm on pace for my 500, as I had 48 and I should have had about 41.7. If I actually break this down, though, I was just over the number because of there being 31 days in that month. I should have had 46.5, so I was ahead of that curve. So I'm actually kind of curious, and I'll kind of keep up these numbers each month. So I don't know if there's anything else I need to do for this little intro here and monthly review or whatnot. So what I will say is thank you so much for listening, and I hope you enjoy coming on this journey with me.
Journey with a Cinephile.
And for my first mini review is going to be one that I'm going to be quite brief with, which is Moon Knight. Because this isn't necessarily horror, but I did want to talk about it. But this is from 2022. This is created by Doug Monick, who also created the character of Moon Knight. This stars Oscar Isaac, Ethan Hawke, and Mae Calamawi. This is an action-adventure fantasy show that is on Disney+, but it's from the United States. Currently sitting on a 7.3 on IMDb and a 3.7 on Letterboxd, with the synopsis being, Stephen Grant discovers he's been granted the powers of an Egyptian moon god, but he soon finds out these newfound powers can be both a blessing and a curse to his troubled life. So the reason I checked this out is it's an interesting comic book miniseries that was about this character of Moon Knight that I'm not overly familiar with outside of using him in a video game. My brother-in-law, Pete, asked me if I had watched this, and at the time I hadn't. I was intrigued, though, because of Aaron Benson and Justin Moorhead directed a couple of episodes. So for this, we are following Stephen Grant, who is Isaac. He works at a museum, and he's struggling because he keeps blacking out, losing stretches of time. It appears that during one of these, he asks a girl out that he likes. He doesn't remember, though. He also doesn't show up when he was supposed to. So, there's also another side to him, and it uses the name of Mark Spector. Now, it's in the same body. This show is flirting with him having multiple personalities. What I like is that this gets explained by the end. Mark is a mercenary who has killed for money. He might also change into Moon Knight. He has the ability from an Egyptian deity of Khonshu, who is voiced by F. Murray Abraham. Now, Moon Knight kills for Khonshu. They go out after evildoers. So the issue here is that there is Arthur Harrow, portrayed by Hawk, who is trying to free a different deity. He has a staff from this other god and uses it to judge the souls of people. The problem is that it punishes people for things they haven't done yet. It can punish you if you have it in your heart and you might do it. Mark and Steven need to come to terms with each other, as well as Mark's wife of Layla El Fauli, portrayed by Kala Maui. So they have to stop Arthur before it's too late. So I'm going to be honest, I had issues getting into this show. It is a shame as it ticks boxes for me. First, we have mythology. I was a big fan of all things Egyptian growing up, so this does hit that for me. I actually wish that when I was growing up, I would have gotten into this comic book character, as that would have helped. I did end up settling in, and I was intrigued to see where this would go. Now, we also have a complicated lead with Mark and Steven. He has multiple personality disorder from a childhood trauma. Now, the ending also throws another wrinkle there. Another aspect is that this superhero kills his enemies, which we don't often see. Now, something else that I haven't gotten into here are the horror movie elements. I wouldn't put this in that genre, as I said, but I wouldn't even put it in the adjacent category. There are dark elements nonetheless. This could be the look of Khonshu, or the exploring the mental state of Mark and Steven. They go to the Egyptian underworld, and we also get the typical Marvel idea that if they don't succeed, then the world could end. I did like this a bit if they would have went into an even darker version, but this is well made. I know that I struggled to settle in, but it's more with the story. It's just jarring. Once I figured things out, I was there. The cinematography is good. There is CGI, but I come to expect that. It does look good. Got that Disney money, especially with the different gods that we see as well. Now, the soundtrack works. There's a great cast of like Isaac, Hawk, Kalamui, and Abraham being the bright spots. The rest of the cast work. I can't recommend this to everybody unless you're into the Marvel Cinematic Universe. If not that, it's just too long and could be condensed into a movie. And I was trying to support Benson and Moorhead as well, but my rating here for Moon Knight was a 6.5 out of 10. And for my second mini review here is going to be one of my favorites from the great Lucio Fulci. This is The Beyond. It goes by the original title of E Tut Vivere del Torero al-Adila. Probably mispronounce all of that, but this is from 1981, directed by Fulci, who also co-wrote this with Dardano Sarchetti and Giorgio Maruzzo. Now, this stars Caterina McCall, David Warbeck, and Cinzia Monrelli. This is a horror film that is from Italy. It is currently sitting on a 6.6 on IMDb and a 3.6 on Letterboxd, with the synopsis being, a young woman inherits an old hotel in Louisiana where, following a series of supernatural accidents, she learns that the building was built over one of the entrances to hell. So this film was my first foray into the filmography of co-writer and director Fulci. I grew up on Zombie, but hadn't seen anything else from him. I learned about him more when I was checking out Fangoria's Top 300 Horror Movies issue, as well as getting into podcasts. I didn't fully understand this movie, but having now seen it a handful of times, I come to appreciate it more. This last viewing was at the Gateway Film Center on the big screen with a new score from Fabio Frizzi. So what I want to say is that I really like the backstory to this film now. We have this cursed book that lays out parts of it. This was the first movie from the Gates of Hell trilogy that I saw. It is the only one that I've seen multiple times. Even though this is playing my hand a bit here, it is my favorite of the series as well. Now that I've established that, I want to talk a bit more about my initial issues with this movie. Nightmare logic of Italian cinema was a problem for me. Having dealt a bit more into movies from this country, I appreciate something like this even more. There isn't the deepest story here, but we don't necessarily need it either. This house was built over top of a gate of hell. Now we have the character of Shewek. I think it's one of those ways how you pronounce his name. And this guy is portrayed by Antoine St. John. Seemed to have been dabbling a bit with the supernatural, which caused it to open. It also caused bad luck in the nearby town, and this is why he is executed in the opening sequence. That's the backstory. Weird things are happening now that Liza is trying to move in, and she is portrayed by McCall. I get the feeling that The Grudge borrowed ideas from this. The house is cursed. Her family member might not be in there since it was closed is what kind of held it at bay, I think. And this is the hotel that he owned. Now that the people are back, the evil is trying to free itself. This becomes City of the Living Dead, the first film in this trilogy where we have zombies. I also wondered why certain people were targeted. It makes more sense with more viewings, which is big for me. There aren't many things that I cannot explain still with this one, I think. What I will say is that not everything makes sense. Thankfully, it isn't necessarily story issues, but it's more with character decisions. It is only with John, to be honest, and he is portrayed by Warbeck. In this climax scene, he sees what is doing isn't working, Now, he sees what does and then continues to almost test that hypothesis. This annoys me every time I watch it. Not enough to ruin the movie overall, it's frustrating nonetheless. Now, that is should be good for the story, so what I'll say next is that I'll go to the effects. They are brutal and I love it. I come to expect that from Fulci. Everything we get here is practical. They use dummies for certain things or like fake animals for others. I still respect trying, you know, and giving it high marks there. Cinematography also helps. Extreme close-ups help to hide things and make it look better. There's also a lot of focusing in on the eyes as well as trauma there, which is a Fulci type thing. It makes me cringe, which is good. Since they went into so much with the filmmaking, I will say that both soundtracks that I've heard with this are good. What Frizzy does just is absolutely amazing. All that is left here then would be the acting. I think that McCall is good as our lead. She does well in this position. Warbeck is okay as John. I like that he's the grounded one and no nonsense. My problem with it is just decision making during the climax. I would also say then that Monrelli, St. John, then we also have Veronica Lazar. There is Giovanni Di Nava, L. Cliver. There is Michelle Marabella, and then Maria Pia Marsala, and the rest of the cast are just fine. They don't have much to do for this to work, though, so I will give credit for it still. In conclusion, this is right up there as one of my favorite Fulci films. It is my favorite of this trilogy, and it's contending with Zombie. I think that's interesting enough story to move through each of these set pieces. The effects that we get are good. The acting is solid for what was needed. Other than that, I would say this is a well-made movie with the cinematography and the soundtrack. Won't be for everybody, but you need to like gore and Italian logic horror films. If you do, then give this one a watch for sure. So my rating here for The Beyond is going to be a 9 out of 10. And then up next, I have The Mystery of the Wax Museum. This is from 1933, directed by Michael Curtiz. This is written between Don Mulally and Carl Erickson. This stars Lionel Atwill, Faye Ray, and Glenda Farrell. This is a horror mystery thriller film that is from the United States. It is currently sitting on a 6.8 on IMDb and a 3.4 on Letterboxd with a synopsis being: the disappearance of people and corpses lead to a reporter to a wax museum and a sinister sculptor. So this is a movie that I saw a while ago. If I had to guess, it would have been right after college, and I probably sought this out since I saw the loose remake, House of Wax, as I was searching out the original movies for the ones that like I had watched in the theater. This is my second time as a part of my traverse to the threes, and I was interested in revisiting this one for some time now. So where I want to start is that we have an interesting premise here. I've seen wax figures before. Now, they're amazing to me how lifelike they can look. Now, this movie is taking it a step farther. I'm amazed that they decided to use this concept this early into the history of cinema. I commend them, though. What I think is funny here is that during the opening sequence, I knew that actors were portraying the wax figures. The only question I have here was Yvonne killing people and making them into statues, or was this something that doesn't happen until moving to America? And I'm inclined to think it's the former, and he is portrayed by Atwill. Now, there's an argument here, though, that isn't the case. There is this disfigured person who is stealing bodies. I didn't remember the reveal, but it makes sense in the end. The argument is that this person didn't start this until they're doing it until they became disfigured. Having that happen made them insane. I also didn't realize that this was something here that was used in House of Wax. I've probably already given it away, but this movie is 90 plus years old. Most everyone reading this has seen the remake as well, I'm guessing. Now, shifting this over, let me go over to the character of Florence, who is portrayed by Farrell. Now, she's really our lead. Yvonne is our villain and being played by Atwill, which makes sense. And he's a star currently. Faye Ray had a big year also being in King Kong. Now, she isn't as important to me in this movie. She is a damsel in distress again. Now, Farrell's our third lead, probably due to her name, but she's also the one looking into everything. She's a newspaper person who is trying to figure out why Joan of the Arc looks like this missing person of Joan. Now, we do know Joan was murdered. Originally thought it was suicide. Police think it could be murder. Her body is taken. There's also another figure that looks like a missing person as well. I'll give credit here, though. Having a woman oversee the investigation is ahead of its time, in my opinion. Florence is a strong, independent woman. She is misguided about the ideas of who her roommate Charlotte should date or even herself, but she's also got a point, and that works for me. Should also say, Charlotte is Fay Wray. Acting is where I'll go next, though. I've already leaned into this topic. Atwill is solid. He comes off as a nice older man, but there's just a creepiness about him. That comes from him being intrigued by Charlotte and how much she looks like his Marie Antoinette statue, which was the centerpiece in London. Wray is solid in that role. I don't know if they gave her a lot to work with, though. The best performance is Farrell. She is witty and hard-nosed. I like that she can hang with all the men that is around her as they try to stop her from getting her story. But I will also say that Frank McHugh, there's also Alan Vincent, Gavin Gordon, and the rest of the cast are solid to round this out for what was needed. So the last thing to go into would be with the filmmaking. Starting with the effects, they are limited but good. I found it creative to have actors play the wax figures. That adds an eeriness to the reveal as well as making them look lifelike. The cinematography is also good. I'm glad that they lingered just enough for us to question, but not too long to lose that mystique. Other than that, I thought the soundtrack fit for what was needed. So in conclusion, I rather enjoyed this movie. We have a concept that is good. I like the truth behind the wax figures in this museum. The acting is solid. Farrell and Atwill lead the way with a solid performance in support of them. This is also a well-made movie, which also helps as well. I can't recommend this to everybody. If you like the history of cinema, especially horror, then watch this. If you want to see the basis for remakes, then I would also give this one a go. So my rating here for The Mystery of the Wax Museum is going to be an 8 out of 10. And I also got to watch Fear. This is from here in 2023. This was directed by Dion Taylor, who also co-wrote this with John Ferry. This stars Tyler Abron, Joseph Sikora, and Jessica Allen. This is a horror film that is from the United States. It is currently sitting on a 3.4 on IMDb and a 1.5 on Letterboxd, with a synopsis being: a much-needed getaway and celebration weekend turns into a nightmare due to a contagious airborne threat. This is actually leaving out a lot of what this movie has in it, but I digress. But this is one that I heard about due to going to the Gateway Film Center. The trailer showed ahead of movies that I caught. Put on a list of ones that if I could make it work, I'd come back to see it. What made me leery was the rating on the IMDb page. I did see it ahead of time, as it wasn't very high. Still isn't. Regardless, I caught this during the opening weekend. So where I want to start is that we have a solid premise. It isn't a new one, as I can think of multiple movies that use fear as the basis. I mean, there's The Fear, which featured a wooden statue that would manifest your darkest things. You have Clive Barker explored this in a short story that was made into a movie called Dread. There's also A Nightmare on Elm Street, as Freddy Krueger feeds off of fear as well. What this one does, though, is something a bit outside the box. There's only one person with a traditional fear in this movie, which is claustrophobia. Another one has a variation on a fear of losing control, which is something that I actually have. Now, Kim also deals with fearing her asthma, and I give credit there, and she is portrayed by Abron. But another thing is that works here is the setting. We are isolated. The only people here are our group of characters. Now, this lodge can be rented as a package. I like that there is a secret in the basement. It is a fitting that I just watched The Beyond in the same weekend. But there is a bit of correlation there, since it could be a gateway to hell. They also use the Hispanic version of a witch, which they call a bruja. Now, I thought that this was a good route to go, since the area in California was owned by Mexico for a good stretch. Now, the elements, although not new, are there. This movie was boring, though. There's my biggest gripe. They focus on the wrong things. If you know me, I love social commentary when it's handled properly. This doesn't do that. One of the fears of a character is a legitimate one. They were pulled over as a teen and the police officers assaulted him. This is too on the nose to be called out like this, what is happening with the cops effectively. I cringe when this was introduced. Another one is near the end. A character is deeply religious and losing that is part of their greatest fear. Now we get an image that audibly annoyed me. Again, it shouldn't. I'm not religious, so when it makes it too much of a point, I check out. Now, there's one more gripe. This movie doesn't state COVID-19. It alludes that there was a pandemic happening and that on television that first morning that they're there, it says there's a bacteria in the area. I hated this originally. By the end, it ended up working for me and what they were getting at with it. What is frustrating is that there's a simple fix so that this movie decides, you know, to focus on it instead. An example is that they use as opposed to other things that I brought up previously. Now let me get away from the story. Next, then, would be the acting. No one is bad here. I do, however, think we have bad writing. Things that are said made me cringe with the awkwardness that can work at times. I just don't think it does here. I like Sakura as our lead. He's good there. Ebron is as well. Andrew Batchelor, Ido Goldberg, Annie Ilon Zen, Terrence Jenkins, Ruby Modine, and T.I. are all fine. I thought that even Mezzi Atwood worked. There isn't a performance here that ruins it. All that is left to talk about will be the filmmaking. I think the cinematography is good. This is shot well. The setting works. I like the isolated location. That is always a plus. The effects can be good. There were brutal things that go down and that works. The blood is solid. I do believe that the CGI and the use of filters, I don't necessarily know if I had a problem with either, to be honest. Oh, no, the soundtrack fit for what was needed. What I will say in closing is that this isn't poorly made on the technical side. In conclusion, this had potential. There are things built in that if they focus on would have made this work. As we have a solid cast, the cinematography and effects are good. I don't even mind the social commentary when it's done right. It's just too ham-fisted here. They focus on things that they can explore. It just needed to be done better. This is a hard movie to watch, though, as I checked out early. I can't recommend this one to anyone. So my rating here for Fear from this year in 2023 is a 4 out of 10. And I also got to watch Victor Crowley. This is from 2017. Was written and directed by Adam Green. Stars Perry Shen, Kane Hodder, and Laura Ortiz. This is a action comedy horror thriller film that is from the United States. It is currently sitting on a 5.5 on IMDb and a 2.8 on Letterboxd, with the synopsis being, 10 years after the events of the original movie, Victor Crowley is mistakenly resurrected and continues to kill once more. So this movie that came out right around the time that I was listening to Horror Movie Podcast, and I hadn't seen any of the movies in the franchise, so I had to put it on a list of movies that I would check out at some point. And then the reason that I finally did was, according to Letterboxd, this was one of the last ones for me to complete the franchise, so I figured I would just go ahead and give it a go and, you know, finally complete it after all this time. So where I want to start is that this is something heartfelt that began this movie. I heard that the reason that Green wrote and directed this was the force behind its creation is that I heard that he made this in honor of George A. Romero and Wes Craven passing away. And he had kind of talked, I know with at least Romero. Now, they were both talented filmmakers and were known for their series of movies. So this was meant to attribute to them as you kind of doing what works for you. And, you know, kind of gave his passion back to want to make this one, I guess. And I can appreciate that to come back here, especially since I believe Green wanted to distance himself for a bit before making this one. Now, to get into the meat of this movie, we are getting a fun, mindless slasher film. I like where it picks up. We have Andrew, who is portrayed by Perry Shen, was our sole survivor. He was trying to capitalize on what happened in that ordeal in this swamp to make money. I don't blame him there. If I went through what he did, I don't know if I would want to go back to work. What I like here is that he was blamed for the murders. It couldn't be proven, so he's not locked up. There are so many times that I think a survivor would be the first suspect in some of these slasher movies, and I'm glad that this acknowledged that. I like that Andrew also doesn't want to return to the swamp where everything happened. There is life-altering money that is drawing him there, which works. Now, where I'm going to go next would be the story of the character of Victor Crowley, who was portrayed by Hodder. He was killed in the earlier one. What this movie does is bring him back, and it makes sense. I love using a YouTube video, as that feels like the times. It is more believable than some franchise in bringing back their main antagonist. And I like that they introduced voodoo, so that also helps here. Now, we also are getting a group of characters that are annoying, so when they're killed, we cheer with the brutality. I can appreciate those elements in my slasher film. Now, the true problem with this is that it goes so much into comedy, and that's the whole series. I think if they would have played this straighter, I would be into it more. The comedy is a bit childish as well, so there is that. What made me laugh is that they're doing some play on words here and there. I don't mind injecting humor. The issue I have is that it alleviates tension for me, and I'm not the biggest fan of that. Now, I'll take this over to the acting. Hodder is once again good as Victor. They don't do much to progress the character. He's just a hulk of a man. He is this character as well. Shen works as Andrew. We have good supporting characters with like Laura Ortiz, Dave Sheridan, Crystal Joy Brown, Felissa Rose, Brian Quinn, Tiffany Shepish. We also have Chase Williamson and Katie Booth. I like the cameos by Tyler Mane, Daniel Harris, Green himself, Joe Lynch, and Tony Todd. Now, the acting here is fine. They're playing the characters how they were designed, which works. Now, all that's left to go into would be the filmmaking. This is shot well. I will give credit to the cinematography. We don't get a lot with the actual swamp. I would like more there, but there's no issues outside of, you know, them not doing that. This takes place mostly on the plane that had crashed. And then, I mean, the survivors are trapped in it with Victor prowling around. So, I mean, that's good. And it also gives them a little bit different of a set. The effects are solid. They were practical with what they could. And I'm guessing there was some CGI, but it doesn't ruin anything here. The only other thing would be the soundtrack, which works for what was needed. So in conclusion, this is a fun movie. I don't think that it's great, but it isn't a franchise that I love. There were some good things that were done in bringing Victor back to life. We get some brutal kills with some good effects there. The characters are annoying, but they're also playing into the comedy. And I also believe for us to kind of cheer on Victor as he disposes of them. This is well made enough. No issues there. This is a shut off your brain popcorn modern slasher. If you're into that, I'd recommend this as it's an enjoyable time in my opinion. So my rating here for Victor Crowley is a 7 out of 10. Then my last mini review for this week is going to be New Terminal Hotel. This was made in 2010. This was written and directed by BC14. This stars Stephen Jeffries, Tiffany Shepish, and Ezra Buzzington. This is a crime horror thriller film that is from the United States. It is currently sitting on a 3.3 on IMDb and a 2.5 on Letterboxd, with our synopsis being, after his fiance is brutally murdered, Don Malik, portrayed by Jeffries, sets out for revenge. So this is a movie that I learned about thanks to my sister, Allison. I believe the reason was due to her being a Tiffany Shepish fan. Outside of knowing that she was in this, I came to this one blind. It took me a bit to find this one as it's a lesser known title. What is interesting is that the DVD I watch is listed as Do Not Disturb as the title, but it's listed on IMDb and I believe Letterboxd as New Terminal Hotel. So it looks like it might have changed its name at some point. So there isn't much of the story here. I struggled with doing my recap originally and remembering what happens. We are seeing a few days in the life of Don. What I'm gathering is that he was successful enough at writing low-budget movies. Now, his agent is Ava, portrayed by Shepish, and she goes into a bit of a panic when she finds that Don has kidnapped the head of a studio, Stanley Glisberg, who is portrayed by Anthony Calanio. Now, without this guy greenlighting his scripts, Don won't be working. Ava believes in him, but she also thinks the reason he's in this derelict place is to capture a spark with writing. Yeah. Sticking with this, as I was saying previously and fleshing it out more, Don lost his spark when something happened to his fiance. His plan is to get revenge and doesn't care if it affects his career. His decision could also ruin his life. I think that Jeffries is a bright spot with his performance. He seems like a broken man that has a plan, and what happens to him doesn't matter. I was impressed there, to be honest. So there's one little bit of story here I want to bring up, as this came out in 2010. The catalyst event is relevant for a major court case that was in the news more recently than this. It was one that involved a studio executive. You might be able to guess what it is from what I've kind of alluded to here. It makes me wonder, with individuals involved with this movie, if there were things being relayed and that went into the script. This could be me conjecturing and kind of placing things into this movie, but I mean, what I'm getting at here has been in the history of Hollywood cinema. It just seems like there could be elements of the truth seeping in here. Now, since I've shifted over to the performance of our lead, let me go to the rest of the group. Shepish is solid here. What I like is that Ava seems like a strong, independent woman, and she is. There are things under the surface with her that Shepish does well in giving us. She is worried about losing her clients, and it bothers her. She is trying to keep this facade, though, and show strength. Buzzington is fine as this damaged man who has become a sadist due to his plight. Now, there could be parts of it before, but I think he likes her to hurt people since he's been hurt. Now, Robert DiDano and James Grabowski are fine in their roles. There's an odd cameo by Corey Haim, who was engaged as Shepish at the time. Other than that, we get a good number of women getting naked if you're looking for that. The acting here isn't great, but we get some bright spots. And the last thing to go into would be the filmmaking. I thought that this was shot fine. There are some grungy look to things, how this is shot, which fits where this takes place. No big issues with the cinematography. They do interesting things to convey the past, which works. What I have an issue with is the pacing. This doesn't seem to know what they want to do, and it meanders. It also isn't good for the short runtime. Other than that, the soundtrack and design were fine. So in conclusion, this movie is boring. I hate to be negative, but there isn't much of a story, and how it's paced doesn't help. There are good elements underneath, though. The commentary on something that has happened in Hollywood was interesting. The acting of Jeffries and Shepish are good. The rest of the cast is fine. I'd also say the cinematography fits to convey the setting of this movie. I can't recommend this, though, as I wasn't the biggest fan. So my rating here for New Terminal Hotel is going to be a 4 out of 10. Now what I'm going to go ahead and do is get you over to the trailer of my first featured review.
I don't understand why we're doing this. We barely know these people.
It's one day. Let's mix things up a bit.
You're just happy you found your fan club. I've been waiting 6 years for your second book. Is it coming out soon?
I'm working on it.
What do you do for money then?
He married Rich.
I actually came here looking for inspiration.
Mr. James Foster, you'll have to come with us.
Here, the punishment for any crime committed is death.
Wait, what did you say?
But for a significant sum, we'll build a double to send in for your execution.
Double.
Think of it as a gift. It's like a new skin working into place. It's for you to complete your transformation.
This is just a little game.
But I can take some blood. Yeah! Show me how strong you are. It's really disgusting. You could just sit there and watch it happen.
You know, James, do you worry they got the wrong man?
And for my first featured review here is going to be Infinity Pool. This is from here in 2023. Directed and written by Brandon Cronenberg. It stars Alexander Sarsgaard, Mia Goth, and Cleopatra Coleman, while also featuring Dungy Sepsic, Adam Bonzek, Jaleel Lespert, Zajed Grakic, Amir Buvik, Alan Katic, Thomas Krushman, Catalina Labin, Camila Fatol, Lena Juka Sambuk, Christoph Kovacs, Roman Tanovic, Amanda Bruegel, Jeff Ricketts, and John Ralston. Now, if I mispronounce any of those names, I do apologize. But this is a crime, horror, mystery, sci-fi thriller film that is a co-production between Canada, Hungary, and France. This is sitting on a 6.8 on IMDb and a 3.4 on Letterboxd, with the synopsis being: James and M. Foster are enjoying an all-inclusive beach vacation in the fictional island of La Tolca when a fatal accident exposes the resort's perverse subculture of hedonistic tourism, reckless violence, and surreal horrors. So this is a movie that when I saw the poster and a bit of the trailer I was in. What pulled my interest most was that it featured Sarsgaard and Goth. Both are actors that I'll watch most everything they do, especially the latter. I didn't even realize that this was the newest run from Cronenberg until looking at the showtimes for the Gateway Film Center to work this into my schedule. So before I get into the movie itself, let me do some featured notes, and I'll start with our director here of Cronenberg. He has 4 films and 4 shorts. All of his features that are in horror I've seen, now all the ones that have come out so far at least, and all of his features are horror movies as well. Now, he started with Antiviral, Possessor, and then this one here. Now, he has an upcoming one called Dragon that intrigues me with the title. Now, he also has the same titles as a writer. Then, moving to over our cast, I'll start with Sarsgaard. He has 59 credits. I've seen 11. Out of genre, I've seen The Northman, Zoolander, and Melancholia, just to kind of give you a few of them there. Now, he has 2 of what he's done are in horror, and then one that's Fringe. Now, his first was Hidden from 2015. This one here is the other one. And then he was also in Godzilla vs. Kong, which I know most people don't put that into horror. I put it as like adjacent because of kaiju and everything like that. But yeah, that's the other one that I was kind of referring to there. Now, next is the actress that I brought up previously of Goth. She has been in 18 total credits. I've seen 10. In genre, she's done 9 and I've seen 7. The only one that I haven't is the special feature on X of The Farmer's Daughters. Now, the other one that I haven't seen yet is Maxine, which isn't out. Now, I have seen A Cure for Wellness, Marrowbone, Suspiria, The House, X, Pearl, and now this. Then last I'll look at is Coleman. She has 16 movies. This is the first one that I've seen. 4 of what she's done are in horror. The first one was Attack of the Sabretooth from 2005. Then she was in Fear Clinic before being in this. Now she has an upcoming one called Cobweb as well. So we start this off in the bedroom of our couple from the synopsis. At least that's who I believe it was. Now they have blackout curtains are drawn, which is why I wasn't necessarily sure. But there's a misunderstanding though when James wants to get breakfast and M thought he had said something different. Now, James is portrayed by Sarsgaard, where M is portrayed by Coleman. Now, this couple is married, but there is tension. James is a writer. He wrote one book that had mixed reviews and hasn't been able to write another. M is the daughter of the publishing house, so, you know, she's the one that's keeping them afloat, and her father is actually the one that runs that publisher. Now, things take a turn when this couple meets another one at this resort. Now, we have Gabby, who is portrayed by Goth, claims to be a big fan of James and his book. She asks about when the next one will come out. She and her husband of Charles, portrayed by Ricketts, invite them along with M out to dinner. This couple invites our couple from, you know, the main one to a picnic the next day as well. Now, what James and M don't realize is that it is breaking the rules. They borrow a man's car to leave the resort. They have a good time, and we actually see the first signs that things are not quite right. Gabby comes on to James, you know, masturbating him. Now, when they go to call it a night, the tragedy from the synopsis strikes. James and Em are shaken. They want to call the police, but the other couple give them the cold, hard reality of being in a third world country and being off of the resort. Now, the police do find out, and it changes everything. This island has a different type of justice. Those with money are treated different. This plunges James into a new world. He is hesitant, but once he is given into the hedonistic pleasures, it changes him. It also might be more than he bargained for. So that's really my recap and introduction to the characters. Where I want to start then is that I'm glad that I gave this one a watch and I came into it blind. I figured seeing Cronenberg's name attached that this would be body horror. We do get that. There is much more going on underneath the surface though. The last thought that I want to have for this opening kind of ideas here would be that this would make it an intriguing double feature with Crash from Brandon's father of David Cronenberg. Now from there, I want to start with some interesting commentary. Early into this movie, there was a comment made by M that James married rich. That is how they're able to afford being here. There is a message about M marrying a man that her father didn't approve of. She did it in defiance since he's rich. I think James has feelings for her, but I'd also say that they're not necessarily right for each other. It takes the ordeal to showcase that since she leaves soon after the major incident, there is a reason that James must stay, but I also think he wants to. Now, part of that is that he has lustful feelings for Gabby. He is enticed when she says that she's a big fan. Now, she's also attractive. Having someone like Goth take on this role with how free she can portray sexuality on the screen is perfect. She also exudes the right amount of crazy. What I also have brought up yet is that Gabby and Charles have a group of friends here. They're rich and powerful as well. What is interesting is that I took a couple of things from them. The first is that they're turning this poor island nation into their personal playground. Part of that is that they're American. The other is that since they're rich, they don't necessarily believe that the rules apply to them. I think that the commentaries are what this is trying to convey here. Now, I'm going to do a brief spoiler section at the end, so I'm not going to reveal things here, but what I will say is that we get body horror. But it's light. It is body horror in the sense that it's horrible what they're doing and not looking at these individuals as humans. Now, the only ones who do are Em and James. The latter seems to lose this as things go on and get sucked deeper into this group. Now, I do need to go to a negative here. I'm in a group chat where people were talking about their thoughts when they left the theater. or like kind of just some of that stuff. But when I left the theater, I wasn't fully sure what the message was here outside of what I've already laid out. They echoed the same thing there, and I think that the message here is muddled. This is a commentary on the rich and how we take advantage of other countries. What it doesn't make sense to me is in the ending. I think that what I've said is conveyed, but what James does in the end left me scratching my head. It feels like the movie lost its way and needed tightening up there. Going along with this, I think it runs too long. Trimming 15 minutes and using that time to shore up the final ideas would help me, I believe. So there isn't anything more that I need to go into here with the story, so let me go to the acting. I thought that Goff was amazing here. That is starting to go without saying. I don't think this is her best performance, but I love how she can use her sexuality to lure in James before showing how crazy she is. She is beautiful as well. Sarsgaard was also good. He's another actor that is always solid to me. I would say that he's a representation of the audience. He's confused and doesn't know who to believe, just like we are. I thought that Coleman was also good. What I like about her is that she's the voice of reason. She wants to do the right thing and have her husband follow that, but he's pulled in by this other group. With that, I'd say that Amanda Bruegel, Ralston, Carolyn Bouton, and Ricketts are all good as that crew. I like that we get a little bit of Crushman here as Detective Thresh. I'm always a fan of him. The acting here is just good across the board. Didn't have any issues with that. Now, all that's left to go into here would be with the filmmaking, and I think that the cinematography here is great. We get some interesting shots with the world spinning and showing different things upside down. It feels to me like this is done to show that the couple's lives are being flipped thanks to Gabby and Charles. Cronenberg has a look about his movie that I dig. Shifting then to the effects, I would say that what we get here is practical and those ones are good. There is some surreal things which pulls in once, you know, how things kind of get shot. Those are trippy, but I don't necessarily know if they fully fit. There was some CGI. I don't remember any of it not looking good, so I don't have any issues there. Other than that, I thought that the soundtrack that we got, it fit for what was needed. Goth's voice gets quite eerie when she snaps, and I did want to commend her once more for that. So then there's a little bit of trivia on the IMDb page, and this was originally rated NC-17 for some graphic violence and sexual content, but was re-edited to be R rating on an appeal. It looks like Neon actually edited this film for that desired rating. The uncut version was screened at Sundance, while the edited one was released at theaters. I would hope that we're going to kind of get like Possessor where we get the uncut at some point. It is rumored that Robert Pattinson was offered the lead but passed. Made more money in the first week than Crimes of the Future did in its entire theatrical run. The latter film was directed by Cronenberg's father of David. So then, in conclusion here, I'm hearing that people love this and others not so much. I thought that there were some good things here. Thought the acting was great. The underlying issues are as well. I'm not sure that the execution with the story is fully there. This movie looks great. It runs too long, though. I also don't know if it sticks the landing. I'm still positive on this one, though. Cronenberg is 3 for 3 with movies that he's made for me. I do plan to revisit this before making my year-end list as well. So my rating here for Infinity Pool is going to be an 8 out of 10. So what I'm going to go ahead and do is I'm going to do a spoiler section. So I'm going to give you here a little bit of time if you would like to avoid hearing anything here. But that spoiler section here is going to be starting now. So to break this down further, the event that lands M and James in jail is that he hits a man while driving back to the resort. They want to call the police where Gabby disagrees. She makes a good point. This isn't the US. She states that the women will be raped and that the men will be beaten. It is doom and gloom. It is decided though to go back and pretend like nothing happened. The police then show up. It appears they were ratted out. James and M are separated, and it is then that James meets with Detective Thresh. This is where this odd part of the movie slips in. What they did is punishable by death. Since they have money, they're allowing James to be cloned, and that clone will take the punishment. M is upset that James would agree to this. We then have realized that Gabby and her friends have all the same punishment happen to them. They've embraced it in different ways that they continuously commit crimes so they can go through this many different times. Now, the police are okay with it since they're getting paid. This is where I can see the commentary about not accepting consequences. Someone else is taking the punishment. In this case, it's their clones. Now, something else that popped into my head about what they're doing with these clones being killed is that I get they haven't been alive long. They do retain memories, though, and that is required for the punishment to mean something. It made me feel bad for them. They are still people. Now, Dr. Moden, who's portrayed by Ralston, at least I think he brought it up, wonders if he is himself or a clone that was put in his place. I wondered that too, actually. Now, James gets caught up hanging out with them, and it sinks into their hedonistic lifestyle because of it. Now, M heads back to the United States, while James stays back. He must, though, because he can't find his passport. He believes it was taken. Now, the group does make him an offer that they will help him get a new one, but there's a task that needs to be completed. Things get surreal from here, and I did enjoy that part of it. What I don't know about is the commentary of what we're getting here. Part of it seems like James doesn't belong with them. He isn't rich, his wife is. He is doing things that deep down he knows are wrong, but he can't stop himself. So by the end of this, the group heads home. James is as well, and it seems like him and his wife are going to reconcile. He stays back, though. He gets rained out on the beach at the resort. Now, this confused me. What I think currently is that they broke him and he can no longer go back to his old life. I just don't know if it's as effective as it could be, in my opinion. So, that's all I really kind of had for the spoilers here. I'd kind of like to hear your thoughts. At the end of this episode, there is going to be a way to get a hold of me. So, if you have something different, definitely reach out. So, I'd like to discuss this with somebody else. But what I'm going to go ahead and do now is get you over to the trailer of my second featured review.
Meet the Gimbal's daughter, Kathy. See through Kathy's eyes. Just when you thought horror films reached an intensely shocking peak of terror, here is Kathy's curse.
She's gone, Kathy.
Well, it's perfectly natural. You've been burnt in a fire. Just wait a minute, and I'll make it stop hurting.
What do you do when unexpected horror erupts all around you? Kathy's curse. Kathy just wants to play with you, but please, don't take her dolly.
I saw you there when Mary... No, you're trying to hide. I saw you there with my own two eyes. Do you understand?
What unknown demon controls a pretty little girl? The Gimbal home. Join a spellbinding odyssey of fright. Kathy is sugar and spice and everything nice. She just likes to keep her company entertained. Kathy loves to play in the attic. You never know what Kathy will come up with next. Enter the bizarre realms of the living dead. Come to Kathy's house. She's waiting for you. She seems to be running out of friends. Kathy's curse. She has the power to terrorize. Rated R.
And then for my second feature review is going to be Kathy's Curse. This is from 1977, directed by Eddie Madelon, who also helped co-write the screenplay along with Myra Clement and Alan Sanz Casanave. Now this stars Alan Scarf, Beverly Murray, and Randy Allen, while also featuring Dorothy Davis, Mary Mortar, Roy Whittam, Bryce Allen, Sonny Forbes, Robert V. Girolami, Rene Girard, Linda Coot, Jeffrey LaFlamme, Peter McNeil, Lisa Nicolet, Hubert Noel, and Sylvie Lenore. This is a horror film that is from a co-production of France and Canada. Currently sitting on a 4.4 on IMDb and a 2.8 on Letterboxd, with the synopsis being: a young girl possessed by the spirit of her aunt, who died as a child in a car accident, soon people around her begin to mysteriously die off. So this is a movie that I didn't hear about until getting into podcasts. I knew that it popped up early on into listening to them, but it was one not. I actually don't hear a lot about it after that. It went on a list of movies to check out, and I decided to view it since it was co-written by Clement. I'm doing this for women appreciation on the podcast here. So I'll start with the director of Madelon, though. As for some featured notes here, he helmed 13 works. I've only ever seen this one, and this is the only one that was in genre. Now, as a writer, he has 7, again, the only one in horror. His co-writer, and what turned me on to seeing this, of Clement, this is their only feature. The other writer is Sans Casanave. They have 2 works. This is the only one in horror, though. Then moving to our cast, we'll start with Allen. This was her only feature. Next is Scarif, who has 34 works. This is the only one that I've seen. 2 are in horror. The first one was this, followed by Murder by Phone, which is pretty interesting because I think I brought that up on the Rituals podcast. And then finally is Murray. She has 11 films. I've seen 2 of them. 3 are in horror. I've seen 2 of them. This was her first in genre. She followed it up with The Carpenter, which is a weird little slasher film that I have seen. Now, the last was Spike of Love, that I have not seen that one. So to get in this movie here, we start in the past. There is a little girl who I believe is named Joanne. Her father rushes in and tells her they're leaving. He says that George is with their mother. It seems like the marriage is falling apart. Now, these two get in a car accident when a rabbit runs across the road, causing them to crash. Now, the car then catches fire, killing them both. The movie then shifts to the present. We have George Kimball, portrayed by Scarif, who is moving into the house from the opening with his wife Vivian, portrayed by Murray, and their daughter Kathy, portrayed by Alan. If memory serves, Vivian had a miscarriage, so they're moving into this house to kind of have a change of scenery. George works in construction and has an important project that needs to get completed. The house is prepared by Mary, portrayed by Davis, and Paul, portrayed by Whittem. Now, their time in the house is odd from the beginning. First, they notice children spying on them from the garden. They don't mean any harm, and they want to be friends with Kathy. Now, she finds a painting in the attic that looks a lot like her. Now, there's also a doll that she takes. It is from this point that she acts differently. There is a presence in the house that is surrounding Kathy. It doesn't want her to leave. It attacks those that try to take her or the doll from her. Now, this includes Mary, Paul, and even Vivian. Now, she has another mental breakdown that has her hospitalized. George is a rational person and is quite busy, so he doesn't realize the dark things happening to his family. It becomes a race against time before the spirit fully takes on the body of this little girl. So that should be enough to recap this movie as well as to introduce the main characters. Now, while watching this, what struck me is that this feels like a blend of Audrey Rose and The Exorcist. The latter would have come out earlier in the decade, and we get The Possession. What is interesting about the other movie is that that came out the same year. Now, the novel would have been out before that, so I could see that as an inspiration. Now, even though I compared this movie to the other two, I do think this one is seeing more what works and borrowing elements while doing its own thing. If you couldn't tell, we are getting a creepy kid movie here. There seems to be a bit of commentary with the wife as well. I could have swore at the beginning that she had a nervous breakdown due to a miscarriage. That is a legit thing to have subtly in your movie. It also makes it heavy. What I don't like is that George isn't caring. There are talks that she is going through some things and that it could be due to hereditary factors. Although mental illness can be genetic, or as a girl she saw her mother, you know, kind of go through some things and it affected her now. Regardless of what the cause, Vivian is going through things and she needs her husband to support her, which he is not. Getting back then to Kathy, I don't mind the idea of the aunt possessing her. My issue is that we don't necessarily get a baseline for the character. They show up at the house and almost immediately she's acting strange. She isn't to us though, since that's all we've seen. There is dialogue claiming that, which I'm not a fan of. We could have 5 or 10 minutes to easily clear that up for me. But we don't get that. What I will give credit, though, is that Alan's performance. She isn't great, but she's also a child. They give her adult things to say, and some of it's clunky. It feels like they didn't want to go full Reagan here. This has, you know, some heavy things that she is pushing onto people while also hurting them. Now, where I'll then go would be the acting. I've already said that Alan is solid. Scarif is as well as the father. My issue, though, isn't necessarily with his performance, but more of the character and how it was written. Murray has some better acting job of the two. We see her come in as happy as she can at that point. She's unstable, but I think that comes through here. Other than that, I thought that Mortimer, Davis, Whitham, and the rest of the cast are, you know, fine. There are characters for Kathy being possessed to attack, and others are there to develop the characters, which works. Now, the last thing to go into would be with the effects and the sound. Now, I think that the after effects of attacks are good. They do different things here that I wasn't expecting necessarily. Now, the blood and gore were fine in a subdued way. The sound effects are cheesy. It makes it feel like a 1950s sci-fi movie. That was a problem for me. It just didn't fit. Other than that, I thought the soundtrack was fine for what was needed. I do believe there is piano music here that can be eerie. The dynamic voice for Kathy's possession is also good. The only other thing would be cinematography, and I thought that worked as well. So before I kind of end out my thoughts here, let me do some trivia on the IMDb page. And to date, Kathy's Curse is the first and only appearance of Alan, who portrayed the titular role. In a 2015 interview, Alan stated that she and her brother Bryce also appeared in the film, only worked as child actors to financially support their single mother. Alan had no desire to continue acting and retired after her one and only film. Kathy's Curse was shot over the course of 6 weeks in the winter of 1976 in Montreal in the Canadian province of Quebec. The editing of this was done in France. All the special effects were done practically. Alan didn't read the script until the first day of shooting. The film marked the first English language feature by the French director Madelon. So in conclusion here, this is an interesting possession movie that comes out post The Exorcist. There are also elements of Audrey Rose too. This still does enough to be its own thing. I like the idea of this girl being possessed due to a doll belonging to her aunt. My problem there is that we don't get a baseline of her normal before that. Alan does well as Kathy. The other standout performance is Murray. This is a well-made movie. Not great, but I would say worth a viewing for sure. So my rating here for Kathy's Curse is going to be a 7 out of 10. Not going to do a spoiler section, so let me get you over to one last break before I close out the show. I would like to welcome you back, and then just to close everything out here, if you'd like to send me an email with any sort of feedback or anything that you'd like to have read on the show, you can send me that email at journeywithacinephile@gmail.com. If there's anything that you send me you don't want read on the show, just let me know in that email. If you'd like to read any of the reviews from anything on this episode or any of the past episodes, that's horrorreview.webnode.com. If you'd like to become friends with me on Facebook, I'm David Michigan Garrett Jr. On Twitter, I'm Buckeye from Mish. Letterboxd, I'm David OSU. And over there, I'll be posting all of the reviews of anything that I'm watching that is horror or non-horror alike. If you'd like to follow my Instagram page, that's David OSU87. If you'd like to follow the Journey with a Cinephile Instagram, that's Journey with a Cinephile, all one word. What I will be posting over there is on both of them the movie posters of anything that I am reviewing. And if you follow my personal one, every now and then you might see some personal pictures if I ever post any, because I tend to forget while I'm out and about. And just to make it easier on you, I'll have all of those links in the show notes. And then the last thing I'd ask you to do is that whatever podcatching device you're listening to me on, if you could go ahead and hit subscribe so you never miss a new episode, that would be greatly appreciated. Also, if you're able to rate and review just so I can figure out what I'm doing that you like and what I'm doing that you don't like, as well as to get out to more listeners out there as well. And for my next episode is going to be Black Appreciation, as I believe this is going to be number 7 as well. And for that one, it's going to be, I've already seen both movies. I'm a little bit behind on some of the stuff, so I just got to kind of get my ideas down and get everything recorded. But that is going to be Knock at the Cabin. I know this is done by M. Night Shyamalan. I did actually realize in the theater that there is an African-American character in it, so that kind of helps me here. And the other movie I'm going to pair it up with is His House, which is an interesting movie dealing with immigration from Africa to the United Kingdom. So this will make for, I'll get into it for a different type of double feature that actually kind of worked better than I was expecting. I'll also do an older Traverse to the Threes movie. I believe that one is going to be I Walked with a Zombie. And then outside of that, I'll have some more, you know, horror movies that I'll be watching or some more fringe ones that I'll do some mini reviews for you. But I don't think there's anything else that you get to speed with here. So what I will say in closing is thank you so much for listening and whatever you do today. I hope you're safe and do it and have a great time out there. This is your tour guide of David Garrett Jr. and I am signing off.
It had been a wonderful evening, and what I needed now to give it the perfect ending.